Hello everybody, and welcome to the third part in our Twin Peaks rewatch. This is The Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Bina007, and as usual, I am joined by our host from Canada, Stephen.
Hello.
Do you want to say your forum name?
Oh, sorry. I'm Stephen S.J. Lee on the forums.
Also our host from East Texas, for now, Shane.
Hello, this is Shane, East Texas Direwolf on the forums, and I'm a gas station. I'm an oral surgeon.
Oh, dear. And our high roller from the Tri-City area, we are joined by the man of indefinite accent, Greg.
Hello, I'm Claudius the Fool on the forums. I was trying to think of a clever literary allusion, like instead of Hester Prynne, but of course I didn't come up with something quick enough.
Would you like to clear up for the listener where you're from, Greg?
Long Island, if you can't tell from my lovely accent.
I love that accent. It's brilliant. I think you should definitely emphasize that accent on the podcast. That would make me happy.
Okay, we'll do that then.
Okay, so today we are doing the final two episodes of Season 1, Realization Time and The Last Evening. And I guess I should just, before we plow into this, ask you guys who've never watched Twin Peaks before, what did you think of the season finale? Do you feel satisfied? Do you feel, if you had been watching this and had, you know, a year to wait for season two, how would you have felt about life?
I definitely would have punched my television set. Yeah, I was way too many questions didn't get answered.
I was wondering, how close was this to, like, who shot JR? Because that's what I was thinking of. In years.
Who shot JR was probably 1983-84, maybe.
Okay.
I remember watching that too.
Right before.
Yeah, maybe 4 or 5 years separating, but I mean, that was huge, right, culturally, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How about you, Stephen? Did you feel satiated by this season finale?
I was very angry at the final scene. I was okay with the episode overall, and then I suddenly realized all the plot threads are unresolved at the end of the finale, which was kind of frustrating. I couldn't imagine how people felt when they said, well, I guess we'll find out what happens next in a year. I would have lost my mind.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate representation of what went down.
How long did they have to wait? Because this is a real short season.
I don't know, actually. Someone should Google it. I really can't, don't know. I'm thinking in the UK it was a year, but maybe it was less in the US? I don't know. But anyways, we will rock and roll with Realization Time. So just to re-emphasize to the listener, what we're going to do is we're going to obviously spoil everything up until the finale of season one, but we will not be spoiling anything from season two, so you can follow along at home very safely. So I am recapping Realization Time. So the episode opens, obviously, with the opening credits. But now that we've examined in great detail the population of Twin Peaks, I don't think we need to dwell on those. At the Great Northern, Coop rejects the gorgeous Audrey's advances given his FBI oath. He has a wonderful line where he says, "What I want and what I need are two different things," which is such a come on. Anyway.
She's really 25. It's fine.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, he tells Audrey he has no secrets. Do you all believe him?
I don't know. I mean, he
does seem to be
so
one of those
strange,
weirdly honest people.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I don't know. I think that's kind of what Coop's character is, right? Like everyone in this town has secrets and false identities, and then Cooper comes in with his seemingly wide-eyed demeanor and unravels a lot of situations that are even kind of just under the surface. I think, for example, of Andy and Lucy's relationship, like that's not a secret, but Coop just kind of walks in and goes, hey, this is clearly going on. He's almost naive in a way. So I'd like to believe he has no secrets.
Well, you'd think because he has that awesome power of deduction that he can just, you know, pick up very subtle cues from people that he's either super good at hiding it himself or is just completely honest because he thinks other people can pick stuff up like that too.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see as we go on. But I always find his reaction to Audrey, like if you're throwing yourself at someone and he offers to get you milk and cookies. So cool.
Malt and French fries.
Oh yeah, sorry, a malt and French fries.
Talk about your troubles.
Indeed, indeed. Poor Audrey. She'll be scarred for life, I think. Anywho. Sorry.
So you're saying he should have had his way with her?
I think there's ways to let someone down that are slightly less infantilizing than offering to buy them malt and fries.
Okay.
No, he definitely should not have slept with her, obviously. But the way he says he doesn't want to, like, what I want and what I need are different, it's so, like, yeah, I could totally tap that, but I'm just not going... It's kind of like, it's just a weird way of doing it, I find.
But even the way he said that, like, it didn't come across as, we're not 100% sure that that's what he means, you know, because he's got so much else going on in his head. That's just how I took it, that he could be more like, just, I'm not dealing with this now, because he didn't give her any looks, really, that were, like, you know, longingly, particularly longing, but I'm super bad with this kind of stuff, so maybe he did mean that anyway.
Oh, dear. Yeah. I don't know. I love Audrey so much. I feel bad for her. Anyway, the next morning at the sheriff's office, Lucy continues to give Officer Brennan the cold shoulder and secretively takes a call from her doctor. Waldo the minor bird won't talk either, but Coop leaves a voice-activated tape recorder, which is obviously the height of technology in 1990, under the bird's cage to pick up anything he does say. And meanwhile, the forensics confirm that Jacques hosted Laura, Renette, and Leo at his cabin. So Coop suggests a field trip to One-Eyed Jacks in the proud and sovereign state of Canada, as they have no, and I repeat, no jurisdiction there. This will be an undercover job for the Bookhouse Boys. Oh dear. Yeah, Lucy, I guess by the end of this episode you know what's up with them, but how did you guys react to all this stuff in the sheriff's office?
I just couldn't wait for the hijinks to ensue, because I knew some fun stuff was going to go down.
Yeah, I was thinking pregnant when Lucy had to call off the doctor.
Did you?
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think it's pretty obvious. In fact, even before then, I think when I was, I'm trying to remember when I watched it the first time, I think as soon as she started cold shouldering Andy, I was wondering if she was up the duff. Anyway, so later that day.
Here, Lucy. No, not inside.
Later that day, a very much alive and functional Leo eavesdrops on the police radio and spies on Bobby hooking up with Shelley. Were you shocked to see Leo alive?
Not at all.
I was hoping to see him in, like, some kind of Phantom of the Opera type mask, because I really thought he got shot, like, in the head or the face or something. So I was a little disappointed.
Oh, dear. That would have been hilariously gothic, though.
Yeah. I did expect some sort of dramatic bandaging around his head. I will admit the same.
Okay. Bobby promises to take care of Shelley. Meanwhile, Maddie, James, and Donna, aka the Scooby Gang, listen to the tape Laura recorded for Dr. Jacoby, which we've already heard anyway. Laura alludes to the fact that Jacoby wanted her and that all men did so. They plot to steal the tape from the night that Laura actually died by having Maddie impersonate Laura and lure Dr. Jacoby to a meeting, leaving his apartment untended. Yeah. What do you think of this plot? I have so little respect for the Scooby Gang, I have to say.
This is probably the plot I'm least interested in at this point.
Yeah, kind of like how even Laura says in her tape how, like, naive James is, and that's kind of like the effect, how I'm feeling. Like, in the beginning, like, I was more invested in his storyline, but now there's so much else going on that it's kind of like I've forgotten about the original, like, why we're here in the first place. And he's just too whitewashed, I guess. But I'd like him to get some closure for everything, but I actually think I care more about Bobby than I do about him at this point.
Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, at least Bobby's interesting and alive for you.
Yeah, he's got better hair too.
Yeah, I agree. Like, the three of them aren't really, like, Maddie is this strange character that I don't know what to make of. And I feel Donna and James were kind of interesting in that, you know, they're finding comfort in each other, a relationship they previously didn't acknowledge. In the wake of Laura's death, that was kind of interesting. But now that it's all just kind of solidifying and nothing's happening, just this strange plot, like, it's not very fulfilling to watch.
Indeed. And I think that was an issue at the time. I mean, it's meant to be. We're meant to invest with the teens, aren't we? And they're just the least interesting people in Twin Peaks. Anywho, at Horn's department store, Audrey riles a customer and eavesdrops on her boss luring her co-worker Jenny into working at One-Eyed Jack's as a quote-unquote hospitality girl. she sees a weird ratings book. He has like this ratings book of girls, which is almost like how a teenage girl would rate boys with little hearts. Which I always found really weird.
You know, you're drawing from your own experience in this instance.
Oh, evidently.
Okay. I was just going to say, you say that like every teenage girl has done that, and I've never heard of this before.
Well, you know, how many teenage girls were you on sort of like bestie friend sort of terms with? To know.
Okay.
I don't know. The listener can write in if the listener is indeed a teenage girl and let us know if this is common practice.
Well, I assumed our lone trucker listener was also a teenage girl, so.
Absolutely. As well as being a Native American.
She's very interesting.
Indeed. She has secrets. Anyways, Audrey sees the weird ratings book and she sees that Ronette was recruited that way and wheedles Blackie's number out of Jenny. How are we feeling about Audrey and what she's willing to do to impress Cooper?
Is that her motivation, just to solely to impress Cooper?
Right, I kind of thought so. What do you think her motivation is?
I don't know, I just thought maybe she was, you know, trying to... Didn't she tell Cooper, you know, she felt sort of like everyone else that she let Laura down, and I think part of her motivation maybe is to sort of see Laura's killer brought to justice. But I'm a little nervous for her. I think she's getting in a little over her head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, she can't get into any trouble by smoking cigarettes in the closet and blowing smoke through the door while she's spying on her boss. But she does it so casually too. Like she's just like no. Like she's. I think she still feels like she's playing a game. Like nothing bad can happen. But I think we're led to believe that some bad actual stuff may happen to her. But yeah, she seems really to not be taking it seriously. It's more like a Nancy Drew, like you know, Harry the Spy situation.
Yeah, there's a definite. That's what I find really sort of interesting about Audrey is that on one hand she's so sophisticated, the way she dresses and her self-assurance, and in other ways she's so naive. And I think there definitely is a sort of Nancy Drew element to this, which is obviously going to come horribly undone soon.
Aside from smoking in her boss's closet, though, I thought, you know, she seemed quite capable. Like, she pulled off this little bit of manipulation and finding this evidence really effectively, especially when we measure it against the Scooby Gang.
Yeah, this is true.
Like, she used real cunning to get this information and put this all together. And, you know, she expressed to Donna that her idea was to help solve this case, to disappear with a mysterious stranger from out of town. So, I don't know. I was impressed. I liked Audrey's character grew a lot for me in this episode.
And there's a certain amount of courage in just calling up a madam of a brothel and putting yourself in that situation. There's something kind of noble about it. Whether or not she's doing it for Laura or to impress Coop or whatever, I think it's impressive.
I'm definitely wondering how far she intends to take it.
Especially by the end of the next episode, I guess.
Yeah.
Indeed. Anyway.
Because I sort of assumed that, you know, maybe she would get this information and, okay, look, here's the phone number of, you know, this lady and One Eye Jacks, and this is what's going on. And here, Agent Cooper. I mean, I think that'd impress him. But not Audrey.
Well, I think the implication is that later in this episode, she maybe was going to just present him with that information, but he wasn't in the hotel to pick up the messages, and therefore she takes her own initiative to go there. So maybe she ended up going further than she thought initially. But anyway.
Yeah, I think that's because the feeling I got was a little overhead, like she didn't see it going that far, like the actual where she was, you know, how that episode ended, but we'll get to that again.
Indeedy. Anyways, back at the Double R Diner, an obsequious Hank fishes for info on Big Ed from Shelley, and Coop tells Harry his life philosophy about giving yourself a present every day, which in this case is a damn fine cup of coffee. Nadine watches Montana shoot Chet on Invitation to Love, and mourns the loss of potential income from her silent drape runners that have been rejected by the patent lawyers. As the music swells, Ed begs her not to give up.
Like, yeah, that was really clever how the music from the TV show is like for them, not for the TV, because it went on way too long for whatever was going on in the show, and it was like it was their soundtrack, not the TV show.
But don't you find Ed a bit weird at this point? I mean, like, he is thinking of leaving his wife, and yet somehow he seems to really care for her in this scene. Like, he's really trying to boost her ego. It's just a weird one for me.
Yeah, I mean, we know that he kind of put that whole, the stuff with his, I the waitress at the diner, Norma on hold, and that he is really committed to Nadine at least temporarily to get her to, you know, help. I hope that's where it was going.
So do you think it's self-involved then? Do you think he's just being nice to her so that eventually she'll be easier on the divorce? Or do you think he genuinely
I don't think it's one or the other. I think it's both. You know, it's gray, and I think that's why it's kind of realistic. But
I don't see it that way.
He still wants out, but he's in for now.
I think Big Ed is motivated by, you know, he seems like a nice or a decent person, right? So, you know, just because he wishes he was with Norma doesn't mean he doesn't care about Nadine, who, as we see in the next episode, like, clearly has troubles, and, you know, their marriage has problems, but that doesn't mean he wants anything bad to happen to her, and she needs care, so he's willing to do that.
Yeah, but I just think maybe from... I agree with you. I think Big Ed's probably a really good guy. I just feel that from Norma's point of view, like, the divorce is going to come as such a shock because he's basically so nice to her. I mean, mixed signals, anybody? I mean, like, from her perspective, he's just really caring. So I think it's just making it harder for her in the long run, in a way. Anyways, so Pete mourns the shrinkage of his newly mounted fish. I love Pete. Harry asks what Josie was doing at the Timber Falls Motel, and she tells him about Ben and Catherine's plot to burn down the mill. Playing Harry like a violin at this point, I think. Safe to say.
Josie's not the sweet girl we might have thought she was.
Are you guys shocked at the turn of events regarding Josie's character?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I am.
Shocked and disappointed, or shocked and much more interested now?
To be honest, I was a little bit confused because I wasn't exactly sure. The plot that Josie has going on isn't immediately clear, and I still actually have to kind of think it out from the finale about what is happening, though I have kind of a general idea. But yeah, it does kind of come out of left field, and it kind of throws you off because Josie's character has been, you're led to believe, is something entirely different.
I think I remember at the time thinking it made her a lot more interesting, that she'd just been this very butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, sweet little damsel in distress. And the fact that she was double or triple crossing Catherine and Pete and Ben just made her a far more interesting character from my perspective. So, I find her pretty intriguing at this point. Anywho, so that night, Coop turns up in a tuxedo, the obvious undercover clothing of choice, with 10 grand of the government's money, on which he always makes a 10% return, which I'm familiar with US equity and bond market returns at the time. That's pretty good. I mean, the US government should just have him gamble with their money.
I was going to say, apparently he does this semi-regularly, goes into cover casinos.
Indeed. Harry...
Secret subplot that Coop is a degenerate gambling addict.
That would make him so much more fascinating. Harry fills Coop in on the Ghostwood plot, but Coop immediately... I mean, I think this is kind of a good piece of action for Coop, because he immediately says, how much do you know about Josie's background? But then it's kind of weird, because when Harry says he trusts her completely, Coop's kind of like, that's good enough for me. So do you think that really is good enough for Coop, or do you think he retains his Tibetan deductive suspicions about Josie?
I think he's retaining his doubts, his, you know, ability to parse stuff out. And he just might not be being 100% honest with Harry at the time.
But if so, that's maybe the first crack in their friendship, because it'd be the first time that Coop's not being honest with Harry, if that's so.
That's true.
I don't know, he seems to just trust Truman, so I can see how maybe his affection for him blinds him to the reality of the situation.
Yeah, but he also knows that, you know, Truman's romantically involved with Josie, so he's got to keep that in his mind, whatever Harry tells him, you know, because it's jaded a little.
Fair point.
Indeed, and the plot thickens because Catherine realizes that Ben Horn and Josie Packard have taken out substantial life insurance on her own life, and she also realizes that her cooked ledger has been stolen. But by God, she told so many people where it was hidden that almost sets her mind.
So, can I admit here my ignorance? Can you, since you know what happened, can you explain the Josie Hank and the Catherine Ben and the Josie Ben thing? Like, can you just explain to me what everyone's hopes are for how this plans out? Insurance and the mill, and like who actually wants the mill to burn down, and because I'm led to believe that they wanted Catherine to die in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay? Yeah. Oh, so it's that simple then. Okay.
Yeah. So both sides want to burn down the mill. Catherine believes Josie will be perhaps killed in the fire, and Josie and Horn are planning to kill Catherine in fire.
Yeah, that's an accurate summary.
Okay.
Hooray.
I just don't pick up on signals then.
Did you all feel sorry for Catherine in that scene? Because she's been such a bitch so far, but I couldn't help but feel sorry for her when that awful conversation she has with the life insurance guy, where you can tell she's figured it out. They know, they both know what's going on, but they're not going to vocalize it. I felt really bad for her. Maybe that's just me. I like greedy capitalist bastards.
I never came close to feeling bad for her, but I guess maybe a little bit, but like I still don't want her to come out on top.
Yeah. I mean, in the first few episodes, she's displayed as such a villain. The classic point being where she just fires that guy because she had a confrontation with Josie. Like, she's not a good person. She's a pretty terrible person. And she's mean to Pete, clearly the best character on the show. So
Pete is the best character on the show. But in fairness, isn't there something better about just being nakedly greedy and ambitious rather than like Josie all sort of like, oh, I'm just a sweet little girl from Hong Kong, and then, you know, at least Catherine's honest about what she wants.
Mm-hmm. And that's the thing, this kind of softens her character, that she becomes much more likable in these two episodes than previously, in my opinion.
Would you feel bad if something bad happened to Littlefinger? Like I kind of feel like she's the Littlefinger in this.
Well, no.
Well, I actually really like Littlefinger.
All right. Sorry.
I don't like Middlefinger at all, and I wouldn't feel bad if something happened to him, because I love Sansa, and I think he's a threat to Sansa. And I hope there's something spectacularly bad that happens to him in the next book, which involves Sansa growing up her. So.
not to derail it into something, another conversation.
This is so minimal by the standards of our derailments. I think this is fully permissible. Okay, so we now reach the long night of this episode. So that night at the sheriff's office, the bookhouse boys don their sketchy costumes to pose as high-rolling oral surgeons Barney and Fred from the Tri-Cities.
Well, why did Ed need to put a curly wig over his already curly hair?
What is the Tri-Cities, by the way? What, where is that? What is that?
I was wondering that myself.
It's in the Midwest, isn't it?
No, I think it's a Washington. I actually just watched a documentary that was set in Washington, and I think it's a region in Washington State, I think. But I'm probably wrong, and someone from Washington is screaming at their speakers.
Well, maybe our female trucker can write in and let us know. Anyway, so, I mean, that's just, like, hilarious. Like, why would you have one of the oral surgeons in black tie, the other one in, like, one of those, like, cowboy sort of string tie things? it's brilliant. Kind of sad that Hawk doesn't get to go with them, though. More racism.
They would have put him in, like, a Tonto outfit, though.
They probably would have known this show. So ridiculous.
Yeah, the Tri-Cities—it's actually—it's a region in southeastern Washington. So yeah, that's right.
Oh, okay.
My own Wikipedia search has created a number of possible categories for the Tri-Cities. My goodness, so, including one in British Columbia. So there you go.
Oh dear. Anyway, so as they leave, Waldo the minor bird starts screaming, "Laura, Laura, don't go there, hurting me. Stop it, Leo. No." And at which point Leo assassinates Waldo the minor bird, spattering blood on the carefully laid out donuts. One of the most iconic scenes of this episode, I think. So brilliant.
And can I ask at this point, because we've seen the donuts set up several times, when I lay donuts out, I never stack them in piles of two? Does that seem weird? Or is that just me? I just keep them in the box.
Do you regularly have so many donuts that there would be sufficient to stack them in neat lines?
No, but Sunday mornings at the bookstore, we get bagels and donuts, and we just have them out. But it seems like an odd... And they're not even the same two types of donuts stacked. They're just two random donuts stacked on top of each other. That just always struck me as odd, the way Lucy stacks the donuts.
Wait, these
are the mysteries I'm involved in.
So every Sunday morning in your bookstore, you just have, like, free donuts for the customers?
Oh, no, like, we for ourselves. We don't care about the customers.
Oh, okay.
Damn.
I was just about to say that's like the coolest bookstore ever, but
they can have lollipops anytime they want them.
You have lollipops for the customers?
Yeah.
What kind of lollipops?
Dum dums.
It's like a barber shop.
Yeah, we give haircuts too.
Get your taxes done.
Not that.
get a dental check. So the death of Waldo, were you guys upset?
I was. Anytime an animal dies, I always get upset.
I last.
Yeah, I don't like seeing animals get hurt, but for some reason, birds, I don't know, doesn't really bother me too much.
They don't count.
He went quick.
Well, Coop had that line where he's afraid of birds, and I was like, who's afraid of birds? But I guess you can be.
He doesn't admit to being afraid. He says he doesn't like birds. I couldn't help but find it humorous because Waldo seems to explode, which is not unusual given the size of the bird, but there is a lot of blood for a creature that size.
I think there's just something about the blood on the donuts that is just hilarious to me.
It also looks like jelly filling on the donuts, but...
Yeah. Leo must be a good shot.
But I don't understand how shooting the bird helps him. Because the bird's already... he must know the bird's already talked. Because the bird talks.
Well, he didn't know they were recording him.
True. He's not the sharpest tool in the kit.
No.
Anyway, so poor Waldo. At One-Eyed Jack's, the boys meet Blackie. Bighead totally fumbles his lines. But he pulls it back with some very suave, flirty banter. So, good for Big Ed. Coop not inconspicuously talks into his mic, keeping Walk up to speed, like holding his wrist up to his mouth. Brilliant. It's like early Bond films, isn't it, where you can't believe no one spotted them.
Yeah, I was going to bring up, I think it's Goldfinger, where they're playing poker outside and the guy's got the giant earpiece and the wire going to Ed, but no one says anything.
Oh, I love Goldfinger. Okay, so Maddie sneaks out to bait Dr. Jacoby. But is seen leaving the house by Leland, which is a slightly sort of weird scene, I think.
Creepily sitting in the dark.
Yeah, what is Leland doing, boys? Is this just another sign of his nervous breakdown?
Yeah, I think so. It didn't seem too out of character for Leland to me at this point. You know, distraught, you know, unhinged a little bit, just in the middle of the living room at night.
He doesn't stop her, though, does he? He doesn't say, hey, Maddie, where are you going? Like, if we had house guests and I was sitting creepily in the dark in my lounge and, like, a young girl who was staying
staring off into space
decided to run off into the middle, I'd be like, yo, where are you going?
Maybe you didn't want to give her a heart attack.
Also true. Anyway, meanwhile, Ben and Jerry Horn are singing with the Icelandic investors. Yet more racial diversity going on there. Ben's annoyed that Jerry's told them about One-Eyed Jack's, which is where they want the signing party. Which, you know... I think it's a perfectly reasonable request.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out that the arson attack will take place that night. And we first discover that Josie's clearly working with Hank. And she is going to lure Catherine to the mill. Although actually it turns out to be Hank that calls Catherine and gets her to the mill. So whatevs. Failing to find Coop, Audrey takes the initiative and heads to an interview with Blackie. And she impresses Blackie by twisting a knot in a cherry stalk with her tongue. So, boys, how did you find this scene?
I was more impressed by the Canadian location name dropping.
Okay, so you didn't find her skills with her tongue impressive?
No, of course I did. I just wanted to get that in there.
Okay.
It's kind of funny. I think the last time I've seen someone do that was probably high school. So that she's like supposed to be in high school and she does it to impress someone seemed
what
appropriate.
What kind of high school did you go to? Is this like a common thing in the high schools of East Texas that girls are like twisting cherry stalks into knots to impress
people?
No,
I mean it was like, you know, trying to be provocative or something. But look, you know, I don't know. I've never seen like an actual grown-up do it to impress somebody.
Indeed. Anyways, so it was, I remember at the time it was a really kind of like, it was like after everyone watched that, everyone tried to do it and like no one could. So there you go. Oh, dear. Anyway, we can finally end this episode. So in the casino, Jacques deals to Coop while Dr. Jacoby is lured to supposedly meet Laura. Bobby sees Donna and James leave to rob Jacoby's office as well as fake Laura. But we realize he and indeed Maddie are being watched in turn. And Bobby hides cocaine in James's motorbike. And that's the end.
I was a little confused by what exactly Bobby was doing. I figured it out, you know, in the next episode it reveals it. But at first I thought, like, maybe he was trying to put some sugar in the tank because you can,
that's
like, mess up an engine that way.
And, oh, yeah, because he made a blow-up, you know, like he was going to be an explosion or something.
And then I was thinking it was something to make it, like, gas blow up because he made the blow-up thing. And then neither one of those happened to be the fact, so, but...
Yeah, Bobby doing a I'm going to shoot you gesture for I have set you up to be arrested eventually seems like a strange mismatch.
But he's a strange boy. I think the only reason I assumed it was cocaine even at the time is because he was dealing cocaine for Leo. And any time I see white stuff in a bag, that's kind of what I think. But maybe I'm just suspicious. So, did you guys like the episode?
I really enjoyed it. I thought it was I had no complaints, and it really got me looking forward to the finale.
I thought it was kind of up and down. The Scooby gang is the low point, and Audrey's putting together what's going on is the high point, and you're obviously tying that cherry stem.
Anyways, do you guys want to move to the final episode of season one?
Do it.
Alrighty.
Do it, yeah.
Alright, we open on some palm trees. We're in Dr. Jacoby's office. James and Donna sneak into Dr. Jacoby's office. They find little drink umbrellas and the coconut with the half-heart necklace and the tape that Laura sent to the doctor. Now we see Dr. Jacoby. He goes to the place that he's deduced that they shot the video with Laura, where the gazebo is. He sees James and Donna drive up, and he drops off Donna, and James drives off, and then Donna and Maddie drive off as Dr. Jacoby is assaulted by someone in a ski mask. What do y'all think?
Well, I clearly can't comment, but what do y'all think?
I hope he didn't get killed, because I actually started feeling bad for him at this point, because he's seeing this person who we obviously cared about, you know, being, he's like, what the hell's going on? I'm a doctor, I trust my senses, and now I'm seeing this.
So does he not know that Maddie's in town? That's what confuses me.
Well, it's a big town. So it's completely different.
50,000 people.
Thank you, Shane.
Thank you for clarifying. Okay.
I did put in my notes, dead question mark, because he seemed to, like, I wasn't sure. He seemed like he might have been dead. He's got hit in the back a couple of times, but he seemed to sort of, kind of keel over. Found out he just had a heart attack.
Yeah, whoever was hitting him, it seemed like they were going out of their way not to hit him in the head, because they just kept hitting him in the back, like he didn't want to actually kill him. But...
yeah, I'm a nasty, evil lurker, but I'm not murderous.
I identified his assaulter as a white male, but other than that, at the time, I couldn't figure out who it could have been.
So
I have a guess later, though.
Who do you think it is?
I think it might be Leland Palmer, that he followed Maddie out of the house, and based on what he does later in this episode, maybe he had some role to play in this.
But why would wouldn't Leland, if he was there seeing Dr. Jacoby watch Maddie, then he would have seen Maddie, and it seemed like he would have said, Laura, you know.
Or, Maddie, what the hell are you doing impersonating my daughter, my dead daughter, yeah.
I didn't say it was a perfect argument, I just said that's who I thought it might have been.
Do you think it is, Shane? Or do you know?
I can't come up with anybody that I think would, you know, seems plausible.
Greg?
You think it's the person from the final scene?
Yeah, I think it's obviously the person from the final scene, but I still don't know who it is. And I so wanted to Google it, but I did not.
So who do you think shot Coop, then? If you think it's the same person?
I have no idea. I think it actually might be someone we haven't met.
Interesting.
I'm wondering...
do you know
it's
Shane?
It's Diane.
Do you know who shot Coop, Shane?
No.
Okay.
I'm wondering if what we saw is really what we saw. Because I don't know, like, how's he going to live through that? Or is he going to be, like, all gimped up? As far as I know, he's in the rest of the series.
Oh, you mean Cooper, not Dr. Jacoby?
Yeah, Cooper, yeah.
Bulletproof vest.
Underneath his tuxedo, because he was undercover. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As an orthodontal surgeon from the Tri-Cities area.
But the episode is called... the episode is called The Final Episode, which is suggestive.
In the Log Lady intros on my DVD, she says something about, in the end, you'll hear three noises or something like that, and I was counting them as three shots.
At the time, did they know if it was coming back for a second season?
No, we didn't know.
I mean, do you know, in production-wise, like, were they sure they were coming back?
Oh, no, I think they knew they were coming back for a second season.
Okay.
Yeah.
He probably is wearing a bulletproof vest, but I don't know, I didn't go there.
I mean, he has to be, right? They can't kill off Coop. You can't kill Coop.
Again,
Bring back Coop.
You guys are just so self-disciplined. I'm just not going ahead and watching the next episode. I'm in awe of your discipline.
Yeah, that's why we were all angry and wanting to throw bottles or punch our TV or do whatever we wanted to do.
For like a day.
Alrighty, let's transition back in here. We see Cooper playing blackjack. Looks like he's pretty good at it. It's Jacques? Am I saying that right? Jacques. Okay. God, that's so hard. I don't know. I have trouble with that. I keep wanting to say Jack. He gives Jacques the broken poker chip, and he says that he's a friend of Leo's. And Jacques says, who is Leo? Trying to play it cool. Then we see Blackie watching the floor on the video monitors while she plays some kind of card game by herself that doesn't look like solitaire, but I don't know. It could be some solitaire variation.
Could be kind of like solitaire.
Yeah. Kind of looks like some kind of tarot thing to me, but...
that's what I thought, too.
Yeah. I was kind of disappointed, like, in last episode and going through this one, that we seem to sort of the spooky, eerie, weird stuff kind of takes a backseat to the, you know, the standard kind of plot. But
it kind of comes and goes, I think. I think there's a balance the writers had to strike between moving the plot forward and the kind of the random Tibetan stuff. And so, yeah, right. I think it's kind of, yeah, it kind of weaves in and out. So it'll come back, don't worry.
All right. Let's see. Audrey comes in dressed as a one-eyed Jax girl. And unfortunately, we do not get a very good full body shot.
But she has a much more virginal look, doesn't she? It's all white lingerie rather than the sort of red black stuff the other girls are wearing.
Yeah. A giant red heart on her back.
See, Audrey sees Cooper on the video monitor, but plays it cool. Blackie says Audrey will see a big shot. Of course, you know, we're assuming that'll be your dad. And asks her to pick a card from the deck, which is she spreads out face up. She picks the Queen of Diamonds, and Blackie touches her hand suggestively.
Suggestively, yeah. In what way?
I think Blackie likes the ladies.
Okay.
Is that what y'all thought? Or
no, I didn't pick up on that at all.
No, I thought that was the case. I'm with you, Shane. That was a weird hand-touching moment.
I thought that was, like, obviously what she was doing. You know, I didn't think that.
No.
You're being coy.
No.
Okay.
That's how I touch, like, all the ladies' hands.
Okay, you're just messing with me. All right. Big Ed, who's apparently lost all his money already, goes back to the truck with Hawk and listens to Cooper talking to Jacques. Let's see. And Jacques got a really cool tie, by the way. Did y'all see that? It's like a red and black bow tie, but it's got like two dice hanging from it.
I did see the dice hanging, and I was trying to like focus on the numbers to see if we're supposed to pay attention. Did it correspond to the domino? Maybe, I don't know.
Oh my goodness! I was just too mesmerized by the disgustingness that is Jacques. I mean, he is just the most awful.
Well, that's what he's supposed to be. He's not supposed to get character. Anything else out of it.
Yeah.
Ugh. Slandering the good name of French Canadian.
I don't think French Canada.
And people named Jacques.
I don't think French Canada would be keen to have Jacques seen as one of their own.
That's right.
Cooper tells Jacques that he's been financing Leo and that he wants Jacques to do a job for him. They agree to meet later after Cooper gives him $5,000 and promises another $5,000 when whatever job he wants done is finished. Cooper asks how the chip got broke, and Jacques tells him that Laura bit it while her and Leo were having sex while she was tied up because she was into that sort of thing. She also explains that the bird was pecking at her shoulders and neck while she was tied up. And the way he describes it, it sounded consensual, I think. Is that what y'all got?
Yeah, to me it just sounds like Laura liked rough sex, basically.
Yeah. We get a scene of Audrey waiting somewhere in her room. Not sure why. Then we go to Shelley. She's dyeing her hair, and Leo comes back and abducts her. Then we see Harry and Andy discussing women at the, I guess it's the sawmill, or somewhere, wherever they told Jacques to go.
The water treatment plant.
Okay. They attempt to arrest Jacques, but he grabs a gun from one of the inept deputies, and Andy shoots him. Yay. It appears he's only wounded. Yeah. Oh. Andy's big moment.
We should emphasize for the Canadian listener that they have lured Jacques to the U.S. side of the border now, so this is a legal arrest.
Right, yeah. So they didn't do anything illegal when they crossed the border.
Yeah,
they
just... I wouldn't want Stephen to be concerned at this point that the sovereignty of Canada had been abused.
Let's be clear, they should have notified local authorities that they were entering Canada.
But yeah,
it was not an official mission. It was a bookhouse boy mission.
They were not entering
okay.
as law enforcement officers, right? So
yeah,
they were entering as vigilantes.
In a court. None of this would hold up. You can't. Half of the mission was bookhouse boys, half is FBI. It doesn't work that way.
No, but I mean, they don't have to admit. All they have to do is say they arrested him in the U.S. I didn't see why that wouldn't hold up.
Yeah, but a good defense attorney would tear that to pieces.
All right. James, Donna, and Maddie listen to Dr. Jacoby's tape. Laura says that James is sweet but dumb. She talks about a mystery man who we assume is Leo that she's been having sex with. She mentions a red Corvette, and James sort of smiles, it's looked like. And James seems to be happy because he doesn't have to feel guilty about loving Donna now, is what I took from it.
Yep.
They decide Dr. Jacoby didn't kill Laura, but wonder how he got the necklace. I also wondered, because when he smiled, it was kind of when Laura mentions Red Corvette, and I thought, I guess he doesn't know it's Leo, because he doesn't tell Cooper later that it's Leo. He just says, you're looking for someone with a Red Corvette. But at the time, I was thinking maybe he realized that was Leo.
Watching it this time, I was like, how dumb do you have to be if you're a drug runner to buy such a conspicuous car with your drug money?
Which Ben Horn points out in the show.
Yeah. At the sawmill, Leo is getting ready to blow up the plant with Shelly in it. And this gets weird, because doesn't he tell Shelly she's got an hour to live? But then we see a whole day pass, and then that night is when everything goes down?
It all that night, though?
Yeah, I thought it was that night.
Well, I got a whole lot of stuff to go through here for this night.
Yeah, but it's a long night. A lot happens.
Okay. That's a busy hour. Let's see, Leo sets the timer and says he's going to go kill Bobby and that Shelly broke his heart. I love that. Did you feel for Bobby, or not Bobby, did you feel for Leo at this time when he yells, you broke my heart?
No. Do you really think his heart was broken by Shelly?
I think as much as his heart could have been broken.
Does anyone else think that, like, the way Leo is the same way that Deputy Andy, like, I can't tell if they're overreacting or if they're just doing an intentionally, like, over-the-top job. Like, it seems like he's, like, a B-act. Like, he's not taking it seriously. Those kind of lines, they just jump out as, I don't know, they just seem weird to me.
But I think, you know, I don't think it's bad acting. I think it's deliberate pastiche because, you know, this is a show that has invitation to love. And, you know, it has an ending that deliberately is spoofing those sort of Dallas-like ridiculous cliffhangers. So I think it's deliberate. I'm going to give the actors the benefit of the doubt on that one.
I think so, too.
Someone in our comments was referring to the director's choice to have actors kind of overact. And, like, that's how the show and his other projects are made, not any kind of reflection of perhaps the talent of the actors.
Yeah, very wise.
But it's not everybody, it's only certain characters. Or maybe just certain characters jump out more. Mm.
I think it's maybe just the characters who are involved in these plots that are really hokey. So, you know, the burning of the mill is an obviously very hokey plot, so it calls for a lot of craziness.
Let's see, we see Nadine at home. She's still crazy. I have in my notes that it's around sunrise, because I thought I saw the sun in this part, which is why I think all this happens in the day, but maybe I just didn't see it correctly. But she's in a pretty pink prom dress or something, setting up a picnic blanket in the house. She puts a letter in an envelope, and it looks like she's going to commit suicide with pills.
Do you think that actually was her prom dress?
That's what I thought it was, because she had referenced, you know, how she knew him in high school and wanted him back then, and I can see her, like, saving that, having that in the closet for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Even though I don't think she went to prom with him, because he was probably with Norma at the time, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Let's see. We move on to Josie and Hank. Josie's giving Hank $90,000. So it seems like Josie paid Hank to kill her husband, who's Pete's brother. Poor Pete. He wants more money and maybe sex? I don't know. It's kind of
wait.
Creepy.
She's Pete's brother? I thought it was Catherine's brother.
Yeah, it's Catherine's brother.
Yeah, it's Catherine's brother. Brother-in-law.
Oh.
Okay.
Oops.
Just checking. Not trying to.
Feel so bad for Pete. Well, now see, that kind of justifies Catherine being a bitch. I don't like that.
Exactly. You see. Interesting.
And then Hank and Josie become blood brother and sister.
With the cheesiest effects of cutting fingers I've ever seen, because you clearly see no cut, but you just see fake blood from the end of the fake knife.
That was Hank's a weirdo, huh? So
yeah,
what he
Josie
does is
goes
he
along
cuts
with it. She drinks it up.
Yeah, like she paints her lips with it. It was really weird and sort of fetishistic. Yeah. I almost thought. How do you guys feel about Hank right now?
I like, you know, even though Big Ed's obviously an idiot, and I kind of like Big Ed and Norma. Is that Norma, right? The one he's sleeping with?
Yeah.
The diner lady, yes.
Yeah. So I'm kind of, you know, rooting for them. So I definitely don't like Hank. And Hank's obviously a bad guy anyway.
Yeah, Hank is kind of a strange character because he comes in just in the last couple of episodes. Yet in this episode alone, he's responsible for a lot of the action that occurs. And we don't yet really have a clear picture of his motivations and his backstory. I mean, we get a lot really quickly, but a lot is happening with him, and it's all kind of coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, we still have more questions than answers when it comes to him, and I feel like a lot of the characters have a history with him that, as viewers, we just don't have, so we're just getting bits and pieces of it through the characters that we know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's see. Catherine is looking for a ledger at the sawmill. Or no, I guess she's not at the sawmill yet. Was she? Because it seems like...
Well, I think so she's in the kind of like the big house in the office that's kind of next to the sawmill, I guess.
Okay.
No,
because I'm trying to think
of
just
at the mill. I thought they were going to Joseph's books.
So she went to the mill where Shelley was strung up, like in the office area. She didn't notice. I guess it's a big mill. Maybe Shelley was like in a corner somewhere of the big mill.
Actually,
there's logistics problems with this. I'm just saying.
Yeah, I think you're right. The timeline is a little screwed up because when Pete and Catherine are arguing, there are employees from the mill like peeking in through the window and they're comically shutting the blinds. But the mill doesn't have a night shift. The employees make that clear at the end of the episode. So that's during the day. So this is a little bit of out of order, I think.
Well, maybe it's end of the day because when the fire starts, the workers stop. There's still people kind of going home. Like, there's still people on the site, so...
But Cooper hasn't even got back from One-Eyed Jack's yet.
Yeah, you're right. It's a bit sketchy. It's a bit sketchy on timeline. Yeah.
So maybe the stuff during the day is concurrent with the last episode, because that way it lines up better with Coop and the rest of the Bookhouse boys coming back to town that night and then the mill burning down.
All right. Let's see. Catherine was looking for a ledger at the office in the sawmill. Her and Pete talk while the workers look through the windows. That was hilarious, as Stephen pointed out. Catherine asked Pete to help her, and Pete falls for it. Catherine's a bitch. Let's see.
I think that's a bit unfair. I really think Catherine's being kind of...
manipulative?
No, semi-honest here and scared. And
that's really? Why she rolled her eyes when
right up until the eye
Pete
roll,
hugged
maybe.
Her.
No, but when she's talking about how they first met and stuff, I thought there was something in there that was honest.
I thought she was just completely playing it. I mean, it might have been a grain of truth in it, but I don't think she was actually, like, believing her hype there.
I agree.
You guys are so cynical.
I simultaneously think Catherine was trying to manipulate Pete, yet I liked her better in this scene. So I don't know. I'm clearly a conflicted person.
I mean, there could be both things going on, right? I mean, she could genuinely be scared and reaching out to him, but also... It just felt like there was such honesty when she said, and you know, I've been so frustrated and I've lashed out against the one person who stood by me. There was some real honesty there and self-awareness.
Well, we've already established that she's good in a pinch with her dance improvisation. She's good on her feet. She can think fast.
Okay, fine.
But, you know, maybe there probably is some truth in what she's saying. The best liars, you know, use the truth to their advantage. So, but I don't think, I think she's done with Pete anyway. At the police office, Big Ed and Hawk tell how Andy shot Jacques while Lucy listens, and it seemed like in the background I could hear someone turn a water fountain on. With Hawk encouraging Andy... Wait, I guess y'all didn't like my joke.
I didn't get
anyway.
It, sorry.
I was
What was the joke?
It was a blue joke. I'm ashamed. I shouldn't have said anything. Okay. With Hawk's encouragement, Andy approaches Lucy in the coffee kiosk station. I don't know what that was, with the little sliding doors. And they kiss, and Lucy tells Andy that she's pregnant. And Andy just walks away.
Cannot process.
Yeah, that's a little too much for Andy, I think.
We also in the scene get like three other cops that are apparently part of the sheriff's department that we've never seen before and we'll probably never see again. Those three other guys that are just there and then they walk away.
Yeah.
Just some more Richards.
Bobby calls the station and tells Lucy to tell Harry that Leo says that James is an easy rider. And apparently this is what prompts Harry to check his gas tank for cocaine. Harry's maybe a better policeman than I thought. I don't know. Because I didn't get that clue.
I haven't seen Easy Rider, but I assume that's a reference to something that happens in the movie, maybe?
Oh, you know what? He does do that in Easy Rider. Yeah. I think they do stuff some drugs in the gas tank. See, Easy Rider is like, it's the movie, but like it's an expression too, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't think of the movie. Good call.
Good taste on Bobby's part that he's seen it.
Yeah. Laura probably made him watch it. Part of his conditioning. To be a drug mule.
Train him to be more dangerous.
Cooper and Harry question Jacques at the hospital. Jacques says that both girls had been to the cabin before and that Leo hit him with a whiskey bottle that night. And he used Leo's shirt to clean up the blood. Then he passed out and Leo and the girls were gone when he woke up. Because why wouldn't girls want to hang out with Leo and Jacques at their cabin? I don't know. Dr. Jacoby is at the hospital and he appears okay. We found out he had a heart attack. And Donna's dad, whose name is Will, is that right? I think so. Apparently, he's the only doc in town.
Yeah, because there's 10 people in town.
Yeah.
Small town.
He tells Cooper and Harry what happened to Dr. Jacoby. Laura and, or excuse me, Catherine and Pete are looking for the ledger again. I guess back at their house. Pete finds his yearbook and he has a moment while leaning on a stuffed bear. Catherine gets a call from Hawk. Oh, Hank. My writing's a little sloppy. Telling her that the ledger is at the sawmill. Or he says, what you're looking for is at the sawmill. So they're setting her up to go and get killed in the sawmill burning down.
Just real quick, did anyone pick... There were a couple of scenes in this, like, with Pete and the bear, and then with Hank when he was talking to Josie, and, like, the horns of the deer on the shelf match up perfectly with his head. Like, there's some weird blocking stuff, which I obviously was intentional, but I didn't know if the bear was necessarily intentional, because I didn't know if he was leaning against it or if it was just a perspective thing. But
it looked like his head was coming out of the mouth of the bear.
Yeah,
it was hilarious.
Exactly. I thought there was, like, something weird going on there with the... using the... trying to say a little extra with the I was going to say stuffed animals, but you know what I mean.
Well, I think he put it... like he leaned his arm on the bear's arm at one point while he was flipping through the yearbook. Does that have any significance, the yearbook, I wonder? Seems like he saw somebody's picture and goes,
His high school sweetheart, probably, I guess.
Yeah. Let's see. At the double R, Hank tries to sweet talk Norma and they kiss. See, Hank, the reason I think I'm pretty sure he's a bad guy, like he got Bobby, who's obviously a jerk, but he's like sort of more or less honest. But Hank's being very duplicitous, like he's doing shady things and hurting people, but he's trying to sweet talk and tell Norma that he's, you know, they're going to make it work and, you know, together, you know.
Yeah, I bet it's amazing that Norma doesn't see through that.
Well, you know, people are notoriously the, even smart people, the people that they care about can trick them is what I'm trying to say. When they're personally involved, you know. Like perhaps Cooper and Harry, you know, he likes Harry, so maybe he's letting Harry's feelings for Josie cloud his feelings for Josie. You know, when it gets personal, people make mistakes, you know, that's what I'm trying to say.
True. Mm-hmm.
In Norma's defense, when Hank brings up that it's their 20th anniversary, I think next week, she does look a little apprehensive and wants to distance herself from Hank, but I think she's also obviously, based on what we know about him, a little afraid of him. And what might happen? Like
she
wants
to
keep him
like,
away.
Won over by him because she does like let him kiss her at the end. It feels like she's being won round.
Mm. Greg's receding footstep.
That's what I was listening to. I was hoping to like catch bits of a conversation. Maybe there's something going on. I'm trying to spy on him.
You're no Audrey Horne, Shane.
No, I'm not. I gave up smoking. Greg, you still there?
I think it's going to be right back, right? So we can continue on.
Oh, okay. Cooper and Harry arrive at the station. Lucy gives them Bobby's fake message, fake Leo message that Bobby left, and says she heard a clock in the background, which they think she has to be at Easter Park, because that's apparently where the big clock is. James shows up, and Cooper goes to talk to him. Leland arrives asking about who they arrested for Laura's murder, because that's what he's assuming. They got Laura's murder. James gives Cooper the cassette tape that they found that Laura made for Dr. Jacoby and tells him he should look for someone with a red Corvette. Harry finds the cocaine in Bobby's gas tank, or excuse me, in James's gas tank that Bobby planted, and they confront James about it. Let's see. At One-Eyed Jack's, Ben gets the Icelandic people to sign and gets a call. In parentheses, I wrote, he receives calls there, apparently.
It's not very stealth, is it, if you're plotting a secret conspiracy to burn down a mill. But by the way, you can forward my calls to the One-Eyed Jacks.
Yeah, from Hank. And he gives the go-ahead for Hank to kill Leo. Let's see. Bobby goes to Leo's. Leo attacks Bobby, and he's about to kill him with an axe when Hank shoots Leo through the window. Bobby leaves, and Leo dies, question mark, watching the bad boy get shot and die on Invitation to Love.
Are you sad to see Leo get shot?
He does make it entertaining. Like, I enjoy most of the scenes he's in for their comedic value.
As will happen later in the episode, I think it bothered me when Leo died because all of a sudden, or appears to die, because he can answer possible questions about the investigation. So if he's dead, we're once again kind of blocked off from getting answers we want about Laura's death.
You're so mercenary. It's like, I only care that Leo's dead because he had information. Screw him.
Well, he wasn't a nice guy.
Maybe he was misunderstood.
He did have a broken heart.
Yeah, that's true.
He had a heart that was broken by Shelley.
let's see. Catherine arrives at the sawmill and finds Shelley tied up. She doesn't immediately untie her. And then I'm not sure if this is supposed to be a bomb or just a sort of fire starting mechanism, but it's obviously way too slow to kill someone like Catherine. So is this just Leo's ineptitude? I don't know.
I think so. The first sort of like not even explosion, the sort of whimpering little spark that comes off, it's just so pathetic. You're like, is that really it? And then it sort of like does then prompt a bigger fire.
You don't need a bomb because it's a lumberyard, so it's plenty of fuel around. You just need the fire to start it. I figure that's what it was.
Yeah, but how is this supposed to kill Catherine? She could just walk away. As she does.
It's true.
Casually, mind you.
After deciding to cut Shelley loose.
But I love the whole kind of like, be quiet, I'm trying to think, as the sort of, you know. There's not a great deal of sense of urgency from her, I don't get.
That scene was ridiculous.
Let's see, at the hospital, Leland sets off a fire alarm to distract the guard, and he suffocates Jacques with a pillow.
Were you guys surprised by that turn of events? I mean, it's pretty extreme.
He's unhinged, but yeah, I mean, when he doesn't, no one's actually said that she's the killer. He's just assuming because they arrested somebody. Maybe.
I saw it coming because Harry tells him, have you arrested someone?
It's this action that lets me believe it's possible that Leland was responsible for beating Jacoby.
In the timeline of events, does it mean that he can't shoot Coop, or is that later?
My notes are almost finished, so yeah, maybe he wouldn't have time to get back. Though we don't know how long, because the Cooper scene sort of, we shift to it and we don't know how long it's been since the last scene at the end.
Yeah, so I don't think Leland shot Cooper. I don't think that makes sense.
No, I think whoever beat Jacoby did shoot Cooper, though. I think that's the same.
But why? Yeah, because why would Leland want to kill Cooper? Cooper's helped identify the person who he believes killed his daughter and therefore has allowed him to take revenge. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
What kind of makes sense if Leland followed Maddie to the gazebo, got Jacoby, and then followed James back to the police station, because the timeline there kind of makes sense.
Yeah, so I get that he could do Jacoby and obviously Jacques. I'm just questioning whether he could also have done Coop. Like, why would he? Not he could have probably, but why would he have done Coop?
Yeah, I don't think it makes that. I don't think that part fits. I just think.
But then again, like, why would anyone?
Timeline for my theory.
Why would anyone want to kill Coop in a way? I don't know.
Because he's a dashing gentleman that might steal away Audrey Horn.
It's Diane. Diane's just sick and tired of getting all those damn messages.
Maybe Diane's jealous of Audrey.
Yes.
Damn. It's all coming together, guys. It's all coming together.
I don't understand Coop as inspiring homicidal passion.
He was wearing a tuxedo.
Which is true, and all men do look better in tuxedos, it has to be said.
Let's see. We go to the sawmill. It's burning. And in my notes, I have, no, Pete, don't go in there. Pete.
He's so brave and loyal. Aww. I just love the way.
Protective eye gear.
Just picks up that fire extinguisher and in he goes. I love
By himself? What's his boys doing?
Yeah, nothing. And where's the fire engine? Like, why isn't the fire service there?
They're already busy at the hospital because of Leland's foolishness.
Right.
It's a small town. There's not a lot of vehicles.
Yeah, I don't care if the other five people who might be dead are dead. I just be dead. Pete's dead. I'm not watching the rest of the episodes.
That's like a deal breaker for you.
Yes.
Do you think he's dead?
No, I don't think. I don't think he's dead.
I'm worried. Hope not.
What is Twin Peaks without Pete?
I agree.
He's one of the Pete.
So who's the other one?
That's a good question.
The log lady, probably.
That actually might be a good fit, like these background characters that really define the show. Aren't we all Twin Peaks?
What does that even mean?
I don't know. I felt on pressure to come up with something, and that's the best I could do on short notice. At least it wasn't a pun.
That's true. We haven't had any puns yet.
No, but we have had some fondling.
Yeah. Unwanted fondling.
Oh, you know you like it.
Okay. Ben closes the deal.
I think we flustered Shane.
Ben closes the deal and asks to see the new girl. A hunchback, WTF.
Yeah, so what the hell queen is that?
A hunchback monk. A Carthusian monk.
She was literally wearing like a brown rope with a rope tied around the belt. Oh my lord.
She's and you said there's no weirdness in the final two episodes. Shame on you, Shane.
Yeah, well, that's definitely weird.
It's very
I did not know that. Hunchbacks and monk robes with ropes tied around their waist.
It's kind of traditional dress for tailors up here. I mean, you're always bending down to hem pants. It has an impact on your back. Good posture, everybody. It's important.
So this is the hunchback sews the Queen of Diamonds onto Audrey's costume. Ben walks in. And I'm just going to assume that they had sex.
Oh, God.
Oh, hey,
she's the new girl. That's
you don't think that Ben would realize it was his daughter and therefore not go through with it?
Yeah, but she's the new girl. That's how he rolls.
Okay.
No, thank you.
I mean, this isn't written by George R. R. Martin, right? It's not quite that weird.
Oh.
So Blackie calls Horn boss, and then he goes on to see Audrey, which we should assume, or I assume, means that Ben Horn is the owner of the One-Eyed Jack.
Yes, indeed.
But that doesn't quite fit with what when he first visited there. He seemed like he was like a common, frequent guest. And I wonder if they rewrote it where it's like, oh, he's going to go from being the frequent guest to he owns the place now. Like, it didn't feel like he owned it in that first time Ben and Jerry go up there.
But you think that every guy who just shows up at One-Eyed Jack's gets the full parade of girls to pick from?
I mean, it's all about presentation.
If he's the number one customer.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. It never struck me before. I always thought it was clear he was the boss, but maybe I just watched it so many times, I just assume that's how it comes off.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on it till this scene here, also. But we'll have to wait till next season, or next week. Because we see Agent Cooper strolling down the hall in the Great Northern, heading to his room. He finds a note Audrey left him, but the phone rings before he can read it. He picks up the phone, and we hear someone talking, and then the door knocks. He puts the phone down, says, hold on, and we hear the person on the phone saying that Leo's been shot, but Cooper doesn't hear that. Cooper heads to the door, opens it, and we see a black-clad person point a gun at Cooper and shoot him 3 times. And that's it.
As if we didn't need one more cliffhanger. Like, I can't imagine a TV show these days, like, getting away with this. Like, you can't do that.
But I think it was a very deliberate, and I think there's interviews with Mark Frost where he says, we just wanted to have the maximum number of cliffhangers we could possibly put in an episode to show how sad it is.
I think we have 5 or 6 characters that may or may not be dead. Nadine, Pete, Cooper, Shelley, and Catherine. Unless I'm missing, that's at least 5. It's like 4 separate literal. It's so much going on.
Is anything tied up in this episode?
Well, you discover Leo's shirt was bloody and that it wasn't Laura's blood but Jacques. So that kind of gets rid of that bit of evidence. That's tied up.
Yeah, it's like the questions that we got answers to actually give us, make it more frustrating, not less frustrating, because like you said, we can't get any more information. Leo and Jock. So it's, they're very clever. But I can just I can picture like in the days where you didn't have, forums and you couldn't just hop online to get answers, like literally going to work the next day and be like, oh my God, what happened? What do you guys think happened? No one knowing.
Yeah, it wasn't a happy time. I mean, what happened was you would just go around to each other's house and watch the videotaped episodes with a notebook and just try and figure it out with your friends. But yeah, it was difficult.
I mean, Jacques does, before he's killed in the hospital, he reveals a lot about what happened that night with between the casino and from the hospital bed. But he doesn't actually give us Laura's death. Like I think he says like Leo and Laura left together. But now that Leo may or may not be dead, that becomes a big question. I stand by my earlier prediction that Leo is not the ultimate killer.
No, I don't think so either. Like, we're willing to believe that what was going on at the cabin was almost like something normal that they did,
A normal night's rough sex.
Definitely a piece of it we don't have yet.
So given that, who do you at this point think killed Laura Palmer?
I think it's someone we haven't met.
I believe the same.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So apparently, what's the girl that's in the coma that was also with Laura? What's
Ronette.
Ronette. So apparently Ronette worked at One-Eyed Jack's, and she liked rough sex with Leo and Jock.
Yep.
Sex with
Jock. Sounds like a nice girl.
But it's hard to know how much that was Laura's influence, because Jacques says that Laura persuaded Ronette to take the pictures for Flesh World. So I think maybe Laura was a bad influence on her.
Among other people.
Indeed.
It's interesting because when they played Jacoby's tape for the Scooby Gang, like Laura just becomes a much less sympathetic character. in the course of the show. You know, she, which I think is obviously purposeful. She starts off as kind of this idealized, kind of goody two shoes angelic character, and then she gets seedier and less wholesome as the season goes on. You know, you obviously, I still want to solve the mystery because I've joined us in the informal Bookhouse Boys, but Laura's character has taken a real beating in the course of the season, and she seems like a less pleasant person.
And we get this all from other people. It's never really, you know, we don't know if these tapes were like something she recorded, like as a, just to get like the dark stuff out. Like, I don't think that's who she was. That's mm-hmm. because we're getting bits and pieces from everywhere except for actually her.
What do you mean you don't think it's who she was?
Like, those recordings could have been something that made something they did in therapy that was like just to get, you know, so for her to open up and, you know, and if we all, you know, I just don't think that that's like, we know it's not who she was because she did have the, you know, a lot of other stuff going on, but I don't think she's the good girl that they think she is at the beginning, and I don't think she's completely the dark, you know, super dark side, you know, person that we see in the tapes. There's some medium.
I think that's probably fair, but then again, you know, when she's saying that, like mocking James for being sweet, which is just an incredibly bitter and bitchy thing to do. I mean,
yeah,
I think
that
sounds very authentic, and
mm-hmm.
it's not like James, when he hears it, thinks, "Oh my God, she was obviously play acting." Or I mean, like, he recognizes that as something she would have said, like,
yeah,
and it lets him off the hook. So I don't know. I think it's a tricky one with Laura, and I think that's why, kind of slightly joking aside, I think when you think of what she was getting up to with Leo and Jacques in the cabin, and you know how easy it was for her to make men fall in love with her, or do whatever she, or manipulate them, not necessarily fall in love with her, I think you have to wonder how far, like, if she really wanted some kind of like rough sex, could she have manipulated Leo into giving that to her? Like, was that really something that he was all about necessarily?
Mm.
Just, I'm throwing that out there. I actually don't know the answer, but you know, I think she's a very, very interesting and ambiguous character.
Mm-hmm.
She's kind of like the woman that we think, like, when Audrey comes along and she's all like seductive and like very mature for her time, and you almost think that she could be the kind of the femme fatale, but it's actually Laura.
Yeah, that's true.
It's almost like, I guess it's on television, it's her goods and her bads are so extreme too. You know, she was almost saintly, and then almost, you know, with helping the autistic kid and you know, all her
meals and
charity
meals.
Yeah, charity work. And then she's running drugs too. I mean, it's not like, you know, I mean, it's just really extreme, her good and bad.
Yeah, but they are the mm-hmm. twin peaks of her character, right? The two extremes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now that's a way better explanation for what the twin peaks are. Good job, Bina.
You just blew my mind, Bina.
Oh, happy to do so.
Hmm.
Okay, any other thoughts on season one as a whole? Is it what you were expecting? I mean, you've been through season one now in a couple of weeks, so...
So one thing I was thinking is, Bina, you told us to be aware of the dream and that more will fall into place over time. So has everything been answered from the dream? I everything that comes to mind for me has, like, Coop's dream about who the killer is.
Well,
except for the stuff we did not see.
A lot of the stuff in the Red Room hasn't fallen into place yet. Like, some of the lines, like, the gum you like is going to come back into style. And, like, there's a number of lines that were uttered in the Red Room that, at the moment, don't have an explanation. So that's all I would say, is that it's still probably worth you going back and watching that, having done season one, and just thinking, what's left to be solved?
Mm-hmm.
Good idea.
But also the whole concept of what is the Red Room, and why did we see him being old, and, you know, all that, just the sort of the overarching meaning of it, I think. But, oh, I don't want to say too much, so. Put it this way, I think next week, when you've seen the opening episode of season two, there'll be more weirdness, and then we can have a more interesting discussion, maybe.
Oh, yay.
Yay. So with that, unless anyone has anything else to say on season one, I guess we can close out this episode of the Twin Peaks Rewatch. Thanks to the listener for faithfully tuning in. And next week, I think we've decided we're going to do the super long opening episode of season two and episode two. So effectively, it's like three normal episodes. So with that, thank you everyone for joining once again, and happy viewing.
Take it easy.
Bye.
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 Just you.
Greg, your mic is exploding.
Are you on mute now? Because it's stopped.
Greg?
We can't hear you.
Just kind of a staticky thing going on there.
Oh. Should we restart the call?
I know what it is. What? It's not the call.
It's not the call.
He's inside the house!
It's like there's a poltergeist inside his mic. It's brilliant. My cable on the headset has a cut in it.
Oh no!
Why did you cut the cable, Greg? That was foolish.
I have duct tape. Continue!
I have duct tape. In another person's mouth, that could sound very sinister. I'm coming for you. I have a shank and duct tape.
For any Canadian listening, this is a very Canadian red-green moment. This is fantastic.
What does that mean, a Canadian red-green moment?
There's a popular Canadian television program called Red Green. It was kind of about rustic Canadian living. It was a comedy show, and one of the main characters would constantly repair things with duct tape in improbable situations, like a leak in a boat with duct tape, that kind of thing.
Oh, well, like a sort of MacGyver thing. Greg would like the listener to know that he didn't mean it that way about the duct tape. He doesn't have serial killer binding girls up in sheds intentions.
He's no Jacoby.
No. Should we wait for you, Greg? How quick is this duct tape MacGyver stuff going to be?
I'd recommend electrical tape, but that's just me.
What's the difference between electrical tape and duct tape?
Electrical tape's rubber.
It's non-conductive. Duct tape is for sealing ducts.
Yeah, but like in the history of humanity, duct tape, I mean, probably 1% of the time that duct tape has been used is sealing ducts, right? I mean, what is a duct anyway?
A duct is a
ventilation duct, right?
In the wall or ceiling, and it's to pass air through. It's like what air conditioning moves through.
Then why would you want to seal it up?
Because you can't have leaks, or otherwise it becomes terribly inefficient.
Yeah, it's going into the walls instead of into your house.
Right. You don't want to pay to air condition the ceiling.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
Greg, we're hearing noises from you.
Hello? And that's about it. Oh.
Hello?
Can you hear me?
Sound better, too. This is wonderful.
No, Pete. Don't go in there. Pete.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say about the cherry stem when I got cut off, was that it was not remotely sexual for me, because that was a thing my dad used to do. Like, he used to always do that trick when I went out to eat. And it was just a weird mixed message for me. And I did, like, she was trying to be sneaky by using the reference from, like, the one book that everybody had to read in high school.
What does that sketchy mean, Shane?
I don't know. That's like, what I'm...
You're casting aspersions on the character of Greg's father or something.
Not at all. Just because he's so using the same technique at dinner that the girl in the show uses to get a job.
Yeah,
as
but
a
my dad does not have steamy, you know, music playing as a soundtrack to his life.
And bright red pouty lips.
But does he imagine a steamy soundtrack to his life, Greg?
Probably not.
Okay. But have you asked him? Because I mean, like, who are we to say?
I'll bring it up at dinner on Sunday.
Yeah, please do. Please report
back.
Ask him
if he can. So if he can still do that cherry stem trick.
Yeah. I mean, ever watched Twin Peaks.
Yeah, maybe he's biting Audrey's style. I mean, maybe that's where he got it from.
Bina, if you could put Audrey's music behind Greg telling that story in the edit, that'd be pretty fantastic, in my opinion.
Actually, I can't. There's I've got both of the Twin Peaks soundtracks, but that's one of the tracks they don't have on it, which is a real shame.
Hey, Bina, I wanted to ask you, that song that I think you ended the last episode with.
Uh-huh.
It's You and I, right?
Yeah.
I looked on the on iTunes on the soundtracks, and I didn't see it on there.
It might be on the second one then. On season 2.
Okay, I might have to look there. Because I like that song.
I like that song. It's kind of weird, but it's kind of cool too. But there's a couple of really good pieces of music in this episode, in the second episode, that I really wanted. Like the piece of music they have in the next episode when Nadine tries to commit suicide is so beautiful, but they don't have that on either. So, yeah, it's a shame.
No, Pete! Don't go in there! Pete!
Jacoby wasn't at the funeral, so he wouldn't have seen Maddie there. And as far as I know, their paths haven't crossed.
Greg, are you fixing your headset?
Sorry, I'm trying to find a headset that works because I can't hear myself talk. It's weird. Continue, sorry.
It's a real thing to make and do episode, isn't it?
I usually pride myself on my preparedness, and I don't want to be the guy screwing it up. But okay, sorry about that.
No worries.
No, Pete, don't go in there, Pete.
I think ST Ward needs to come in. Entrapment.
To see but
it's
if
not entrapment.
It's not entrapment.
I don't think so either.
No, is ST Ward a lawyer?
ST Ward's a lawyer, right? ST Ward.
Is he?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
I think ST Ward's a lawyer.
We'll have to find out in the comments.
We will. Okay.
But yes,
I feel bad that I didn't know that.
I acknowledge that our sovereignty was only modestly violated by this action.
you were merely fondled. It wasn't rape.
Oh,
oh boy.
Boo. Very bad.
Oh, duh. Okay. Moving
it's
on.
It's unwilling, unwanted touching, Bina. It's all not okay.
Yeah, but it was just a light grope. It could have been worse.
It was one of those things that was appropriate in like the, you know, 70s or 80s, but now it'd be sexual harassment.
Exactly, exactly.
Harassment's always harassment.
It was acceptable in the 80s.
A dark and troubling time.
I was... Never mind.
No, please say what you were going to say.
You were tying cherry stems in the 80s? Is that what you were going to say, Shane?
No, I was going to say I remember it fondly, but a dark and terrible time. But that's just because I was young. We always sort of what's the word I'm looking for? We think of when we were young as a special magical time. Even if it wasn't.
Nostalgia?
Yeah, I suppose.
Rose-colored glasses.
There you go.
There's no such thing as the good old days.
No, Pete! Don't go in there! Pete!
Tolkien wouldn't have made these mistakes.
Nope.
Well, Tolkien also wouldn't have had people kissing at any point. So.
Let alone twisting a cherry stalk into a knot.
I'm pretty sure Luthien did that, just saying.
No, she didn't.
Got very serious, Odo.
Yeah, you've kind of offended Greg, I think.
Sorry, Greg.
No spoilers. Shane hasn't read the Silmarillion or the sexy version of it, which is out there. So no spoilers.
Oh my goodness. Okay.
I'm sure there is totally a fanfic sexy Silmarillion porn version.
Oh, we discovered it. I found a whole website dedicated to Silmarillion erotic fiction.
Really?
Yes.
I'm sure there's more than one.
Tolkien's Silmarillion
wonder and tragedy of modern life.
Please feel free to share the link to that. That sounds hilarious.
No, we're keeping it classy.
No, Pete! Don't go in there! Pete!
I stand by my comment that I don't think I'm masculine enough to hang in that podcast.
Oh, I'm definitely not, but that's why I'll be there.
That'll be a blast.
Yeah, there's a lot of macho beard posing going on that.
I'm just sporting a mustache right now.
Well, I have to say, as one of the few people who's shared with the ladies of Walk a picture of yourself with your shirt unbuttoned, I don't think you have anything to fear from that podcast, Shane.
Thank you.
Audrey Horne music should be playing right now, my goodness.
I want to get that Audrey Horne music. It's kind of, if I were like more clever, I'd probably, I don't know.
Isn't there like generic steamy music out there? I'm sure you can find that pretty easily.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I always wanted to get my place rigged up so that when I opened my front door and walked in, that Wanted Dead or Alive by Bon Jovi would come on. But Bina, you should rig up your place so that when you walk in the front door, like Audrey Horne's music comes on.
Wanted Dead or Alive. Oh, that's brilliant. Actually, we were having this discussion at work the other day about like what's the most embarrassing pop concert you've been to when you were like a kid, like which group are you now embarrassed to have been into? And it turned out like one of the most senior guys who works for me had like, been to not one but two Vanilla Ice concerts, which is but yeah, my first ever rock concert was Bon Jovi when I was 11, and I was like in love with John Bon Jovi, which is so embarrassing.
Why is that embarrassing? Bon Jovi's awesome.
Yeah, but you don't still think Bon Jovi is awesome, do you?
Yes, of course.
I think it's clear that he does.
No, Pete, don't go in there, Pete.
If you want a good book to read, I just finished a book about zombies and Nazi zombies in the Caribbean called The Night Boat by Robert McCammon. It's a really creepy, but a good vacation book, especially if you're down there.
Nazi zombies in the Caribbean.
Yeah, it's about a U-boat that was cursed by a new guy, and then they all turned to zombies, and then they.
As is what to happen. No, Pete, don't go in there, Pete.
I wanted to bring this up in the episode, but when Coop hands over the cracked poker chip to
the evidence.
Jock, it's like, this is critical evidence.
Yeah,
what are
chain
you
of custody
doing?
Right out the window.
It's the only thing that links Laura to that scene, you rube.
There's that rube word again.
Every once in a while, I just take it as a serious crime show, and I get really upset.
No, Pete, don't go in there, Pete.